Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here with a fantastic author, legendary writer in Los Angeles, Maren Carmian, author of The Rape and Recovery of Emily Dickinson, In Her Words, Poems of Witness and Worth. Maren, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Tyson.
Oh, thank you, Maren. Well, you know, if you don't know Maren's work, she's a fixture of the Los Angeles writing community. If you're interested in books and you go to book signings, you frequent bookstores, and you talk to fellow book nerds in the area, chances are you've probably either stumbled across Maren or her book, The Rape and Recovery of Emily Dickinson, which has been out for a couple of years now, but definitely hasn't declined in enthusiasm and popularity. Maren, do you want to give us a little bit of an overview of the book and then go back to why you got interested in this topic in the first place?
Oh, all right, Tyson, and before we go any farther, I want to thank you for this opportunity. It's really wonderful to do this with you, and I've always appreciated your appreciation and support of my book. And, you know, I refer to it as my brave little book because it is really quite iconoclastic. As a matter of fact, I in 1991, when I had what I describe in my preface as this terrible epiphany, meaning that this mystery lover, as she is known, it's part of our literary folklore that she has, that she had. There must have been someone who has just been coined in that rather hackneyed way, the mystery lover, and a mysterious person, man in her life. And when I had this insight, I was really practically undone by it. I mean, I spent about 6 months, you know, Googling before there was Google. And I thought, you know, I can't be, because after all, she's been read and studied by literally millions of people over the last century, and I can't be the only one to have seen this or to have read this. And I, you know, I just kept closing the book on it, thinking, no, you're reading into it. And but then I would open up and I would see this poem or that poem, and I think, well, you know, this is what she's saying. And the insight actually was simply tripped by a poem of her childhood that I had, the insight rather, I saw that she wrote about her childhood pain, which I'd not, even though I've read this poem any number of times, it's the one that would have starved a gnat to have lived as so small as I. And I thought to myself, my goodness, I wonder how many childhood poems did you write, I mean, of her childhood pain, because clearly this was the case. It was about, as I've said in my book, a sense of non-existence. It would have starved a gnat to live so small as I, and yet I was a living child with food's necessity. And how many poems did she write? Not that many, but there are half a dozen that are, again, clearly about her childhood and the pain of it. And anyway, that was the trapdoor for me, you know. And because it was in going over that, I thought about this mystery lover, and I knew, as everybody does know, that the only person, actual person, physical man in her life was her father. And as I've already said, I thought to myself, well, gracious, it can't be. I mean, I can't be the only one here knowing this and or reading this. So, but then I had to just, I just had to accept that perhaps I was. I mean, as it turned out, Tyson, there were clinical psychologists, and this is a huge subject for me, who at about the same time in 1990-91 were also making more than mere speculations about this being the galvanizing central part of this poet's life was this relationship which her father had imposed upon her. And and one of those people actually came out with her own book, A Wounded Deer, the Effects of Incest on the Life and Poetry of Emily Dickinson. And it's published by Cambridge Scholars Press, and that was in 2006. And I just set out to do what I did in the 1990-91, and first it was note taking, and I had to wear three hats, basically. Of course, I had to write, I was a writer, and then I had to do the reading, which I did of all the major biographies, and then of course the primary source, my primary source, was the poetry, the collected poems in the Johnson edition. And then they counted the poems as being 1,775. Apparently that number's gone up in the last 20 years, and meaning it's, I think now it's hovering around 2,000 poems. But I used the Johnson edition. And and I read that. I read them, as I say in my preface again, a candle power reading, line by line. And I did that three times in the course of the book, which is only right. I needed to do that, and I did. And so I think to wrap up this section of my experience with my book, just had to say, well, I have my conviction. I have made a core interpretation, but my mission is not to convince anybody else. I've even said in my book, you know, you either hear her or you don't. And so then, that is where it is at for me. And I've given you quite a bit. Is there anything you want to ask?
Does it end there? Obviously you have a lot of interest in this subject and subject matter. Where does it go from here? Are you going to continue the Emily Dickinson story in many ways?
There's not going to be another volume. I may do another edition because it's not so much about, well, it is somewhat about rephrasing something or two. Not much, because I worked so hard on this book that it came out nearly perfect, really, in terms of, we talked before about typos. There's hardly a one.
I haven't noticed any.
Yeah, and
you've had a lot of great mentors over the years, too. Are there, do you want to talk about anybody that has influenced the book and the writing process that is notable?
I don't know if I would designate her as a mentor, but she certainly has been a supporter of my book. I'm speaking of Catherine McKinnon. And she is renowned, and better than renowned. I mean, she's just an incredibly important person socially and legally. I mean, and on a global basis, where women and sexual harm is concerned and injury. And, she was the one really that created the grounds for sexual harassment in the workplace. I mean, that was because of her that women were given any kind of legal recourse. And she's been quite wonderful. I mean, she early on, meaning when I've had my manuscript finally, I was talking about three hats. You know, I was the writer, the editor of these poems, and researcher. And my only real primary source was the poems. I didn't go to Harvard, for instance, and look at things firsthand, and what we call. But anyway, I turned to her because I thought perhaps she would give me an endorsement, but she did not.
Okay.
But she did write. She kept up, and up till now, really, a correspondence, an email.
Okay.
And she would say things like, "Maren Carmine, I read this and learned a lot from it, and found this illuminating as well, confirming of what I had long felt in reading Dickinson's poetry." And obviously I'm reading from her email.
Mm-hmm.
And after the book came out, before the book came out, I mean, Jim Natale is a marvelous poet here in Los Angeles, and he gave me a wonderful statement, as did the sociologist, Dr. Samuel Oliner, who is a distinguished sociologist and respected, and he made a beautiful comment. And then and then quite frankly, a friend of mine who is a psychiatrist and diplomate, she also offered to read my book and to give me a comment. And then after my book was published, Jerry Stahl, of all people. I say that, he's a novelist, and
yeah.
Of course he's one of the best novelists of this last century and this century, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, American novelist,
yeah,
he must be one of the top. I mean, he's at the top of the heap, really.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I mean, I was amazed that he said what he said about the book, which was just over the top.
Well, do you want to read what Jerry said and then tell us a little bit about your history with him?
Oh, well, my history with Jerry was that I did a very careful reading of his first book, Permanent Midnight, and I thought that it was, in fact, I compared the title to The Air-Conditioned Nightmare. I mean, you know, it was a beautiful title, and I read his book carefully, very carefully, and we met over that, and you know, he was very sweet to put me into his acknowledgments, and I, and I, you know what, Tyson, I can't find the comment sheet here, or it must be here, because I had it, no.
But we can come back to that, or we can post
yeah.
that, but... But that's,
really?
That's wonderful.
No, it was, and I did not expect him to do what he did or to say what he said. You know, mm-hmm. it was really wonderful. And
what are some of the criticisms that people have had on the book? Have there been any? Because I haven't heard any. I mean, very rarely do you. I have a book that's out there that is critically perfect, but I hear nothing but the most amazing things from other people about this book.
Well, you know what, Tyson? It's like a wonderful poet in Kentucky, Bowling Green, Kentucky, Frank Steele, because there's been a real silence from certain quarters.
Okay.
And I think what it is, it's as he said, you can't, it's an iconoclastic book. You can't, that's why I call it my brave little book. You can't throw a chamber pot onto a beloved poet or icon. And people will, especially the literary people, I mean, you know, other poets and other writers, novelists, they will take it as I have, you know, done just that, thrown a chamber pot on her. And they don't see what I see in terms of my brave little book is based on this person who was diminutive in size as being incredibly brave to endure what she did. I mean, incest is known to be wounding, mortally wounding. That's a phrase again in my preface. Women, and most often it is women, simply kill themselves. They commit suicide, is what I'm saying. And or simply destroy themselves. You know, Mackenzie Phillips is a huge exponent of what illustrates her life, illustrates what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
you know, the slow destruction of the self, if not the, you know, the simple offing, and which is a trite way of putting it when someone is killing themselves. But anyway, so there's a very real silence. There's a thunderous silence. I can understand that from one set. I can. On the other hand, I personally gave way more weight to, you know, in people's intellectual lives, to their regard for the truth, and that somehow that truth would become beautiful, simply, as I said in my title, Poems of Witness and Worth, and that this poet lived through tremendous pain, and you know, she's no more, I think what I tried to say, and I've not only tried to, I mean, I have said in this press kit that I have. I mean, I've made two pages, but I say at the very start of my press kit, in my preface of The Rape and Recovery of Emily Dickinson, in her words, Poems of Witness and Worth, the reader is assured not all of Dickinson's poems in the complete poems, the ones we love, are about the relationship with her father. And hundreds of poems are without the specter of Edward Dickinson. A poetry of pain of significant centrality in her collected work only in part delineates Emily Dickinson's experience as a victim of incest. So I've tried to take care of people who, you know, who would have these feelings of protection towards the poet. And then just to understand that she wrote, she, you know, I think it was Keats who was saying, you know, truth and beauty, that she alternated beautifully. In fact, she entwined them, truth and beauty.
Sure.
And so yes, there's been, I mean, say there's been a silence. I've sent my book to, I've even sent it, well, I won't really name names here, but people who've had their own books out in the last few years. Well, one name I will make is Christopher Benfrey, because I'm sure he wouldn't mind to have his name named. I sent him a book, but I didn't hear anything from him. And he's not alone. I mean, I'll say that. I mean, you know, he's not alone in it at all. And I sent it now. I won't mention the name of the poet, but it's a major poet. A woman, and in fact, one of her poems was recommended to me as being about rape. And anyway, I sent it to her, didn't hear a word. I mean, not even, whereas Wendy K. Perriman, who wrote A Wounded Deer, now her book is relentlessly academic, and I would recommend it certainly for anyone who is serious about their own reading and understanding of Emily Dickinson and her poetry and her life. Well, now it is Dr. Perriman. When she published her book, she didn't have her PhD, but now she's Dr. Perriman. She wrote a very sweet note back, very courteous note back to me, you know, thanking me for the book. And that just that kind of response, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway.
I mean, you haven't heard from these people yet, and as we all know, sometimes it just takes a while for great ideas to, you know, move through the world. But one thing I wanted to ask you is, or maybe you can elaborate on this, you know, your subtitle is an autobiography of Emily Dickinson through her poems.
Right, right.
You know, but you're the author of this book. Can you explain a little bit about why you chose to subtitle it an autobiography?
Well, because that is what I refer to as, in fact, actually a friend gave me the phrase core interpretation. Marn, you've made a core interpretation. So I've used that practically every time I've spoken about my book, you know, being a core interpretation. All right.
Sure.
Well, obviously, the core meaning would be autobiographical. And that when I say, and also, you know, it's almost, it brings the rebel out in me, to be honest with you, Tyson.
Sure.
Because one of the big academic no-nos, and there, you know, you can't imagine the stupidity that abounds in academia. I mean, it's amazing to me. But that being said, which maybe could have gone unsaid, but it's true. I know.
And now I'm sure that you will have...
What?
I'm sure that your book will be on many syllabi after this as well.
Oh, I betcha. Anyway, well, the ones that matter.
Sure.
Speaking of which, I did find myself in my book is in a wonderful a bibliography at the University of Washington, Western University. Anyway,
wonderful.
It's a very no-nonsense bibliography. I mean, it's not a junk thing. I mean, and there I was. So anyway, there's some hope for academia, isn't there? I'm joking.
I like those things.
Back to about the no-no and how what tripped that. Speaking of one's tongue and a trapdoor. It's a big no-no to read her poems autobiographically, so I'm trying to get out here. You're not supposed to read her poems as being anything to do with her life. I mean, that I'm not exaggerating, Tyson.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is a huge no-no. And here you're sitting, what if I'd been a young girl in class and read and... In fact, I read online, when I say young girl, there was a young woman several years ago. It was one of the, like a blogging thing, you know, and I was scanning down and reading down, and she said, I all wondered if that poem wasn't about rape, you know. Well, now, there you are, you know, a free mind, and someone who is thinking openly and deeply. You know, it's not even about, like, I'm right. You know, that's the horrible thing about incest. They're rarely witnesses. And that's why I did use the word witness in my title, because she did stand as her own witness. And when I talk about her bravery, and I talk about what she endured and what she did in turning to her poetry, that's what I'm meaning. She was her own witness, Tyson.
That makes sense. Absolutely.
And I want to put in here, because it's a good thing, I wrote it to Professor McKinnon. And I said, albeit her genius did not derive from being incested, any more than Joan of Arc was a saint because she was burned at the stake, but because she would not separate the truth of her experience, her existence, from her art. That's what I love about her. That's what I love about her. And by the way, there's a whole slew of poems that finally make sense because of what I passed on, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I think it's efforts like yours that, you know, really continue to help these poems live on. You know, the critical nature of what you have to contribute to this is very important.
Right. I guess at the risk of sounding immodest, I think so too. But I, you know, it's like I get a kick out of saying, you know, there isn't a false or real modesty on my part. But, you know, the thing is that I worked as people ought to when they do anything that matters, you know, really, really, really hard for almost 20 years, Tyson. You know, and I mean, you know, what, 17 or 18 years, and the book production itself, which was a whole year, I had 4 author review copies. And did we say it was self-published? I always am honest about that. It's through Ex Libris. And I did what I could as an independent scholar and an author, you know, I went to Book Soup, and I went to Skylight, and I went to Bookzone at UCLA, and they all have my book. You know, Glenn Goldman was still alive when I took my book in, and I never got to really speak with him, but he took my book on consignment, you know, which was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's how I met you, and I mean, your support has been just, speaking of Glenn Goldman, and amazing. You were amazing. And it's just kept this author's heart beating. I was going to say something about, you know, all the, oh, I got a big kick out of when the book was finally, you know, out. I think maybe it was even still in PDF, in book production, you know. And I saw that the book itself, like the book proper, as I call it, you know, chapter one to the last chapter, was a mere 93 pages. This chapter, millions of words of being written. I can't believe this, you know. But yeah, there it was. And there's more than that, but the preface, and I have a lovely afterwards, and I have something called Images and Ideas. Actually, it's quite, I've kind of done a work, I've not kind of, did work, that any reader could be their own scholar, and that is with the indices of images and ideas. Do you want me to? I would like to talk a bit about that. May I?
Yeah, please. Absolutely.
Well, I'll read the paragraph or so. I think the first paragraph probably will do it. Anyway, it's at the end of the book, Indices of Images and Ideas. The complete poems of Emily Dickinson, edited by Thomas H. Johnson, serves as the primary source for this book and is the reference for the following indices of images and ideas. These are the first lines of poems in my book and the first lines of poems not included, yet which are germane, having the same ideas and images, and that may in their turn serve the reader to confirm, or not, the specific consistencies, constancies discovered in the aggregate sense of her poetry. A tapestry of poetry by the doomed and redeemed daughter of Edward Dickinson has a consistent connotative value in the brilliant hues and agonizing shadows of this father-daughter relationship, you know. Anyway, I spent a huge, well, of course, it's always work, it has to be, on this, so that, as I just read, I mean, a reader can, I mean, if they trust that, I've actually did put a bit of a disclaimer, there may have been a poem or two that slipped through the rake, you know, and maybe I did make a mistake with a poem or two to include, but I doubt it, you know, because I was very, very, very careful.
Yeah.
And Tyson, that...
it's powerful stuff.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right.
Well, the bookstores that are, you know, you touched on that a little bit. You know, you mentioned Book Soup and Skylight and those people that are, have been very supportive. Is there are there any other stores out there outside of the Southern California area that have been supportive?
Well, no. I mean, online, of course. Amazon,
yeah.
Barnes & Noble,
sure.
And Borders,
sure.
And, you know. I'm my own press agent, so to speak, or public relations person, and I haven't been all that good, really. I mean, I've done what I could do here, and
sure. Well, you're a writer. That's what
right.
What you have to focus on.
And this is where this interview is wonderful for me, perhaps. I mean,
great.
Who knows who's listening? And
well, you know, lots of important people listen to this. This broadcast
uh-huh.
channel. So, anyway, I think it's just imperative for everybody out there to go out there and buy this book, or at least check it out. It's called
right.
"The Rape and Recovery of Emily Dickinson," The author is Martin Carmian. You can visit her online at marncarmian.com, which is marncarmian.com. Mm-hmm. And Marn, thank you so much for participating. And
well, yes, and Tyson, I have also my video on YouTube.
Okay, great. And her video on YouTube, so you can go to YouTube.
Right, it's Emily Dickinson for Women will get you there. Emily Dickinson
there
for Women, which has almost, it has over 1,300 views.
Really, 1,300?
And by the way, I did find Jerry's quote, and maybe
that's the perfect way to end.
And I also want to mention that Daryl Sharp, who is a publisher in Toronto,
mm-hmm.
Inner City Books, is a niche publisher, so he would not have offered to publish me, but he really liked my book. He said, I'm very impressed with Maren Carmine's painterly ability in The Rape and Recovery of Emily Dickinson, in her words, Poems of Witness and Worth, to insightfully reveal the confluence of her life's circumstances, her poetry, and her conflicted psychological anguish over the incestuous relationship perpetrated by her father. It's Daryl Sharp. He's a wonderful, astute man. And Jim Natal, you know, the poet,
mm-hmm.
in The Bee Trees and Talking Back to the Rocks. This is a provocative, ambitious work of passion and compassion, investigative scholarship and poetic insight. Dickinson's work is newly revealed as if seen under a black light. Jim Natale is a wonderful, wonderful, decent human being and poet. And then Jerry, Permanent Midnight Painkillers was his last book. Anyone who loves language, poetry, and a unique, almost preternaturally perceptive critical mind cannot help but be dazzled and enlightened by Maren Carmine's amazing work of literary analysis. I expected Tyson for it to end there, by the way. He goes on with Rape and Recovery of Emily Dickinson. In her words, Poems of Witness and Worth, Carmine's insights would be enough. But lucky for the reader, at times her own sentences ring with authentic poetic intensity that at once probes and evokes the lines penned by her illustrious and ever-mysterious subject. The Rape and Recovery of Emily Dickinson exists as a phenomenal, one-of-a-kind testament to one's writer's obsession and dedication to solving the mystery of her own muse. What Maren Carmine has achieved is nothing less than a truly haunting, truly beautiful masterpiece of poetic investigation. And I've nearly passed out at that point.
It is, for sure.
Well, thank you so much. This has really been an interesting experience, and I hope it's been a good one for those listening.
Absolutely.
A beneficial one and fruitful one.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much, Maren. Maren Carmine, The Rape and Recovery of Emily Dickinson, thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you.
You on a debris at the Sunday morning market. You were starting to the odds and ends. You was looking for a bargain. I heard your footsteps at the front door. And that old familiar love song. Gosh, you knew you'd find me waiting there at the top of the stairs. Ah, when there not the devil. With the General Workers Union. And yet that they'll never change a thing. Well, they won't fight, and they're not working. Left you on the debris. Now we both know you got the money, and I wonder what you would have done without me.